Hello, folks. This is Michael Veazey from Amazing FBA with 10K Collective Podcast for 6 to 7 and even 8-figure Amazon sellers. Today, we are going to continue with our guest posts from the E-Commerce Leader podcast, a podcast I started recently with my co-host, Jason Miles. Jason is Shopify's one of Shopify's top 1% Shopify store owners, been making a living from that for about a decade now, and is Udemy's top-rated e-commerce instructor with, I believe, over 30,000 students now. So, very good guy to talk to you about e-commerce as a whole. Now, this is continuing the big picture look at your business as a whole, not so much Amazon-specific strategies or let alone tactics, but looking at the business model that you're operating and becoming conscious of it. And in these unusual times that we're living in, where there's geopolitical threats ranging from COVID to Brexit through to China and its relationship to the US, never mind China, its relationship to the UK is recently more of a thing coming up as well. Okay, in short, there are lots of reasons why you want to evaluate carefully what you're doing from a strategic point of view, and then you may want to make new or different decisions. So we're going to talk about various different things today. We're talking particularly about how to evaluate your business model and to see what strengths it has and indeed what weaknesses it has and whether you may wish therefore to change it. And then we're going to include two very top level questions in how to evaluate the business model. Warren Buffett's idea of that building a castle with an unbreachable moat, his idea of the monopoly, how to give your business model a simple but robust score out of 10, very, very helpful when you're considering your next move, the question of how to scale up, the one criterion on which retail arbitrage scores highly on, there's not much else. What else have we got? The mesmerizing power of near zero marginal costs. Find out more by listening. And then digital products versus physical products as well. There's lots of interesting things we talk about. Again, for instance, 50,000 foot view stuff. But I think sometimes when you're busy scaling the ladder, it helps to see what tree the ladder is leaning against, as they say. So hopefully this will be something rather different from the tactical stuff and Amazon focused stuff we've done. And I hope it's interesting. As ever, if you enjoy it, this time, rather than just subscribing to Amazing FBA, go over to The E-Commerce Leader, which is 100% Jason and myself. It's a conversational podcast, if you like, a co-hosted podcast, not an interview-based one. It's a rather different feel, but it does mean that we can dive deep into these topics and we think about things strategically. So I think it goes hand in glove and complements very well the 10K Collective and Amazing FBA podcast stuff. So do go and check that out, The E-Commerce Leader, on any good podcast app near you. And of course, we have a website for the show notes, theecommerceleader.com. That's theecommerceleader.com. So no more ado, I'm going to let you listen to our discussion about evaluating business models. Have fun. We are Michael Veazey in London, England.
Jason Miles in Seattle, Washington.
More importantly, you are the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be. We're here to get you there. For show notes with links and resources mentioned today and for other juicy resources like downloads and free mini courses, just visit our blog, theecommerceleader.com. Let's jump in. Mr. Jason Miles in Seattle, Washington, how are you?
Good, man. How are you in London, England?
Yeah, London, England. I always love it, London, England. Like, where else would it be? No, well, it is, but I mean, where else would London be?
Is it London, UK? I don't know these things.
London is indeed in England and the UK and Britain and the British Isles, just to confuse everyone. But also, I just wonder where else it would be, you know?
Man, the branding of that country is really screwed up.
Tell me about it. Is it a defensible business model, I ask myself. So to business here, then, we are talking about a profit strategy today. Well, that's a subset of profit strategy, which I know is your favorite topic in the world. And I'm sure that's a great thing for your clients. And we talked last time about the critical importance of the business model in the underlying structural thing that drives profit. So then the question became, how do we evaluate a business model? So what are your thoughts on evaluating business models?
Yeah. Well, when we left the last conversation, we really teed up sort of these two big questions. The first one is it scalable to a large number? And that would be the first thing to think about to really evaluate. Can you get whatever you're doing, can you get it to some sizable, meaningful thing? And I think we could probably clarify what we mean by that. But then the second big question is it defensible? in some way? I mean, you know, can you create a long-term value proposition that you benefit from defensibility? So these are the big top level questions I think that go into the evaluation process, and then there's questions that flow out of that. That's sort of, I guess, the opening commentary. So.
Excellent. Those seem like very, very good questions. So I want to say a couple of things. First of all, I think defensibility is absolutely critical, particularly in my experience in the Amazon space, because it's so hyper competitive.
Yeah.
And I know you've got a cunning, what's your phrase about the defensibility analysis that you do?
We have a model we call I keep unpacking these different models. We have a model called 7 layers of defensibility that we use with clients, and I've taught before. And so the whole question of, can you create something that has long-term business value for yourself and own that value? There's ways to evaluate that. There are structural things. Of course, the classic, I'll just tease up two things, but maybe that's a whole different conversation. The first two things you look at is, you know, can you create a brand? Warren Buffett, of course, is the classic commentator on these topics, and he has this idea of creating a castle with an unbreachable moat. When he talks about that, he talks about the power of a brand. And then the second thing that most people look at is, can you create a monopoly through various shenanigans, tactics, strategies, legal rights, that kind of thing? And if you can't create a monopoly, you know, there are things that are close to it, near monopolistic attributes. But those are just two out of like 7 layers of what you would look at to create a powerful, defensible, business model.
Excellent. Well, so I'm looking forward to hearing about that, but I think that's going to be for another day, because we've got a lot of thoughts. I know that you and I have been discussing about the scalability piece, which is obviously pretty critical. And that's more kind of resonates more easily with people, because everyone's taught by the courses that you should be scaling a business to huge revenue overnight. For some reason, Millions. It's a bit of an obsession. So I guess we're starting with the one that is... people are very open to that idea. So obviously we've got to get some kind of rational analysis going on here. So what's your approach? Are we just going to give it a sort of a score in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a way to actually evaluate business models where you really literally score a model. And so let's walk through that. I've got sort of the template I use for that. But the first question, I guess, back to the very top of the conversation is it scalable to a large number? Should be top of mind. But I think that can trip people up. And so I'd love your thoughts on what you consider what is a large number, and then what does it look like to scale? And I think I have a few opinions about how people make common mistakes as they think about these things. You mentioned one, which is just an obsession on, I guess,
revenue.
Getting to a number, like getting to top. But as you work with your 10K collective people, and you work with your mastermind groups, what do you see people gravitate towards in terms of that question of scalability? What does scalability mean to your, to the newbies, but then also to your veteran people?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that people, so those are two different questions. Let's talk about the veterans first. I mean, the veterans, I'm not sure they necessarily think about it that way, just to be honest. They want to scale. But I think for them, I mean, a lot of people, once you're in motion, it's not about looking at the market potential. It's looking about growing what you already have. And most people are aiming to do pretty aggressive things like 40, 50% revenue growth a year, maybe even doubling. And that's very much a revenue target, which obviously I know your passion for profit, and rightly so, that is already a risky approach. So of course we've got to talk about what we're scaling, which we haven't even talked about. So when we say scaling to a large number, what are we scaling to a large number?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's when you look at like an Amazon brand new person, what are they taught to do? Well, they're taught to probably get viral launch, start to do some research on, what is the potential of item number 42 in category number 59 on Amazon, right? So the plastic spoons or the whatever hair care product or whatever it is, how much sales velocity is there? And, there are tools out there that give us that kind of info, right? So that's the first thing that I think people look at is, how much of this is being, you know, sold on Amazon. I mean, that's the first lens many newbies and even veteran sellers. I mean, you know, you can look in Amazon and you can deduce from the numbers what the math looks like on these, you know, specific products. I think that's the first thing that comes to people's mind. But I will tell you, you won't find my products on Amazon. You not even as a other competitors. The what I sell is not on the Amazon marketplace.
Yeah.
You cannot just find what I'm doing and say, oh my gosh, that's a good number. I'm going to like get into that business. There is no version of that that can occur. But I do think that that's the first way people look at it is the velocity of units that are moving. Yeah.
Well, I think, this is, suppose talking about total addressable market. And I spoke about this to Tommy Griffith of, what's his place? Clickminded.com. He used to do, he was head of, Airbnb's, SEO and also for PayPal. So he's got some pretty, you know, decent SEO chops, very bright guy, but he
is that a podcast episode. Sorry. Just to tease
it's
that out.
It's a podcast episode that I've done with him in with the 10K Collective podcast. Yeah. When we could maybe invite him in, I'm sure he'd be happy to chat. But what he used to do there is that they would take the sort of total universe of keywords on Google, which is obviously much broader than Amazon. Cause yes, you wouldn't find your products on Amazon, but you would find it through Google search, I guess. So, yeah. Or for that matter, somewhere else like Pinterest. I know your guys are huge on Pinterest, but the point being that you start with that and then you do some metrics like the percentage of clicks you think you would get if you were at the top of page one on Google. And you know, you can do the same on Amazon. And then, you know, it comes from basically you look at the total addressable market, which all the tools on Amazon do for you, which is to say how much money is being made per month in this market on Amazon or even broader through Google, which is a bigger lens, if you like. So the total addressable market size is, I guess, the formal word for that, right? But then my question is always, never mind how big the pie is, what percentage of it could you win for yourself? Which, again, relates to the defensibility piece, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I think that's where I see some errors occur when people are brainstorming new products.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And the error in logic is that it has to be a big number. Like, you know, as soon as you say, what's the total addressable market, then you've put yourself in a position to say bigger is better. Well, actually, I would just argue that it could be possible that smaller is better. Because if you say, what's the total addressable market, and you say in your mind, I want a big number, every other marketer on the planet is thinking the same thing. So the bigger the number, the more professional marketers you have to eventually compete against. So the smaller the number, then the fewer professional marketers you have to compete against. And in fact, in some categories, in dying industries, nobody even wants to operate in the space because they think it's a dying industry. And so you just need to think through what is it that you're actually wanting to do with the question of scale. And you know, I sell digitally downloadable doll clothes patterns on pixiefair.com. You can go check it out. You have a catalog of about 3,000. That is a subset, little tiny corner of the sewing industry, which most people would say, is that even a thing even in existence? Which is a subset of, I guess, craft and like, you know, hobby, which most people would say, meh, maybe.
Yeah.
So my whole caution to people when they're starting is, don't go for something super competitive. Don't go for a big TAM. Look for an underserved market. And I guess that's my point about scalability is, you know, you can get in this trap that you want to avoid. So
I agree. I mean, it's interesting that we're touching on defensibility, even though we're talking about the scalability. You kind of can't avoid it, can't you? But my question to you then is that the right question? Can it be scaled to a large number? Maybe that needs to be defined to, is this niche big enough such that if I dominate it, I can scale it to a big enough number to have a comfortable living for my family or something. That's a hell of a long question, but maybe it's that kind of question that is a rational question, right? What do you think? What are your thoughts?
I think that's exactly right. And it goes back to Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek book, where he really talks through the idea of what is your ideal lifestyle and then your product muse, as he referred to it in that classic book, such a great book. is the muse has to work for equipping you with what you need to have a nice lifestyle. And, you know, so there's a big difference between you having a great house and car and family fun and, you know, food in the pantry versus trying to build an industry level business. You know, I mean, it's a very different, but you have to kind of start with your own goals in a way.
Yeah.
And if you can find the smallest possible underserved market that will, you can dominate, that can get you to a livable, nice outcome, then I would say that would be smarter than finding something where there's professional marketers that you have to do battle against every day.
I couldn't agree more. And here's what we've come to then. I guess in the business model analysis, which is evaluation rather, which is critical, but we're trying to sort of do it objectively. But what I would say is the first objective criterion I would have is before you evaluate your business, and this is, by the way, another episode, right? Before you evaluate your business model, it's like evaluating a vehicle. Okay, well, there's a Tesla outside, which looks very nice, but it doesn't fit my budget. Therefore, in evaluation of the car as a car, I would say it's amazing. You remember, I'm a bit of a car geek. But for me personally, it doesn't make sense in my finances. My wife would divorce me if I spent it on that rather than paying down the mortgage. And so I guess before you can evaluate the business model, you need to evaluate your own objectives or set some objectives. And then... and set some goals. But then once you've done that, I think it's probably going to come down to, you know, what business could I sell for X amount of money that would enable me to have passive income for the rest of my life, i.e. effectively retire, or what is going to create a fairly passive cash flow? And I guess that's another question, right? That's going to enable me to comfortably live at whatever level. So I guess if you set an income figure, then you can come back to your question, your thing, which is what's the smallest market that I could dominate that will produce that figure for me.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so that's scalability, right?
So that's the scalability piece, yeah.
You've got one down. Okay, let's talk through some other ones. So what do you think is, as you work with, you know, your Amazon sellers and others, what do you think some of the criteria in their mind are in terms of the business model when they're talking about, should I do private label? Should I do retail arbitrage? Tell me about wholesaling. You know, what's the first thing they're thinking about?
Well, that's a good question. The first thing they're thinking about isn't necessarily what I'm thinking about when I'm trying to help them, which is one of the issues as a coach you have sometimes, right? You have to go, well, I want to help you, but in order to help you, I need to gently deconstruct the question you're asking and ask a better question that I think will serve you. So their question is normally, how do I make, you know, X amount of money in the shortest time with the smallest amount of money? And my question is normally, how well equipped are you in terms of your experience, your knowledge of a marketplace, your capital and the time available to actually have any kind of chance of building a defensible and scalable business? And I try to filter out the people I work with one-to-one, especially if they're early to the table, by making sure that I have capital requirements and time requirements and time commitment requirements, not necessarily to me personally, but to the business building process, that even if you're going to have a go at, you know, at this, that you don't half do it. You give yourself 6 months as a bare minimum and a bare minimum capital. So I think that that's a slightly different question. And then the other question that people come to me with, though, is does it work? Does this private label thing work? Does Amazon work? Does, you know, should I build a Shopify store?
Does affiliate marketing work or drop shipping?
Drop shipping is the one.
Yeah. I get the most questions about drop shipping, to be honest.
Really?
Okay. How do I set up my Shopify site for drop shipping? It's like, have you ever done drop shipping? No, but I heard I can make a lot of money doing it.
Yeah,
so let's talk about drop shipping. Not saying it's a bad thing, but I'm just saying there's pros and cons to it. So anyway, does it work? And that's a really central question. And I guess I would do as a nuance to that. Does it work for a common person, a common man, common woman to run? And that's a key question. If you have to have a PhD to pull some of this stuff off, it's not realistic. You know, I mean, so...
Interesting you say that. I just have to say, one mastermind that I ran, an early iteration of it where people didn't seem to be doing very much in sales. At one point, we had three people with PhDs in there. One was a biologist, somebody had one in film study or something you wouldn't think is particularly helpful. I've also had people with MBAs. I know you have an MBA and it shows in your thinking, but this guy again, just did a lot of analysis, but didn't take any action for months. So it's very interesting that actually, I'm not sure that a PhD helps, just to clarify that.
Yeah.
Or an MBA, weirdly, which I would have thought is a no-brainer that it would help, but it didn't.
That's the point. The question is, like when I used to be an HR guy. My original first career was human resources, and I would work with managers on recruiting, and they would say, I want to hire somebody who has a graduate degree and whatever, or PhD. And I would say, no, you really don't. Do you? Do you really want that?
Yeah.
Because those people are hard to find and really expensive. Don't you want a minimum wage worker? And they would like, no, they'll never be able to do it. And I was like, well, that's so what you're describing is a process that's too complicated. So the question is the process simple? Because what you really want is a very simple process that two or three average people can show up and execute on. And the manager is responsible for creating a simple process. And so, you know, the value proposition of retail arbitrage, for example, let's just to get very practical, is that it commonly works for people if you know math. And it's not hard to do. We taught my kids to do arbitrage as one of their first online things, and you know, when they were in high school. And so that, I guess that's the point here is it commonly work for an everyday person, you know? And I think that's a key evaluation question for business models. And the answer should be, yeah. I mean, it's not hard to do.
Should it work? Yeah. That's a very good point. And I think I'd nuance that a little bit by saying, does it work for a particular kind? I mean, I guess, you know what, it depends whether you're trying to mass produce courses or whether you and me, that you're trying to work one-to-one with somebody or somebody's trying to evaluate for themselves. I do think a self-event, again, coming back to the point of, I can't avoid the fact of evaluating a business model means I have to define first for whom, you know, so how much money do you want to make? How much money do you have to put into the equation to start with? How long are you going to give it for? That sort of mundane question. But also with the business model, more subtle psychographic questions like, you know, how good is this person at creating and running systems, processes, and how much experience do they have in the space? I mean, I find that a lot of people that have done well with private label that I know started off with some retail arbitrage back in the day. So they're familiar with Amazon. Yep. They've had successes, so they built some confidence. They often come, they've got analytical brains. Sometimes they come from business analysis type backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So I think those things feed in. And I agree that it's desirable to have a model that commonly works. Yep. And I guess that, you know, private label wouldn't score very high, for example, on that one compared to retail arbitrage. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you should dismiss it. I think if you're going to add the nuanced layer of evaluating yourself or indeed a client accurately and matching them up with a business model, which I think is really important.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just, for the fans at home here, document what we've done. So the first question is it scalable to a large enough number for you to make a living off of or to fit your goals and needs? Is it defensible, which we've said we're going to dive into later? And then this third one is, does it commonly work? Is it something you can execute on? Yeah. Okay, so let's rip through a few more of these evaluation metrics, and then maybe let's apply a few of these to some common business models.
That sounds great. So I'm just scribbling a couple of notes, which will be, as ever, at theecommerceleader.com. And one of the things I think I would like to, if you're up for it, deep dive into the whole thing of the entrepreneur and themselves, their self-awareness, setting goals, you know, what goal clarity, which a lot of people just kind of go, well, I want to make money and retire. But what does that mean? Do you really want to sit on the beach with a laptop? A lot of people have been sold that idea. Do you really want that? Think it through. And then, you know, evaluating your own skills and experience. Because I think a lot of people start off with that mismatch between themselves and that thing. So anyway, I'm just teeing that up if you're up for that discussion.
Sure.
Okay, so another question then, which is top of the mind in terms of the classic pitch, sitting on a beach with a laptop, is can you sit on the beach without a laptop and your business still runs without you? In other words, can it be passive? I think that's really critical.
Passive, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the buzzword that we all love and hate and all that, it's... Can it be passive? Passive income is so great. That phrase in the e-commerce space, of course, means different things to different people. I think there are layers of active work versus sort of portfolio management, or, you know, you can talk about this in some detail. I think the question is, one first question about passive income is just defining what you mean by technically, is it passive, or do you mean you just don't have to personally do it? You know, I mean, if you build a really awesome small business and you're a really good manager and you have somebody running the business for you, you can be anywhere you want because you're sort of you're a passive owner of an active ongoing business. So, I mean, that's the first question is it technically passive income, or can you set it up so that your team runs it for you? Now, okay, go ahead.
And then I was going to say, sorry, I think that goes in layers to your point there, which is a really critical question to find passive. Yeah. I think, as you said, there are layers of work. And I think that if you can set it up so that the day-to-day running is through systems and automation, particularly with Amazon selling, because Amazon does a lot of that for you. It's not passive. Somebody's literally running around a warehouse 12 hours a day. It worked very hard, but you're just not seeing it. So it looks passive to you, but you've outsourced that. And then if you outsource customer service and various other things, you automate things, you know, if you can check in once a week and maybe do 5 hours a week, then I guess that's the kind of dream that's sold to people. And that's a kind of passive, right? In the sense of the day-to-day operations are taken care of.
I wouldn't call that passive income. I would call that you've created a systems-driven business. E. Myth Revisited is a book
you talk about. Beautiful book, yeah.
Systems-driven business is very different than passive income. So let me technically define passive income, I think, as an economist.
Yeah.
Would I think, and that is income that you're deriving from an asset you own that literally takes little or no work to maintain. So, of course, a portfolio of cash or stock or whatever is passive income if you have income flowing off of an asset. Our business model is digital, patterns that we sell. And so we have royalty-based income. We, in our business, we call it royalty-based income. And so, you know, my wife designed, for example, a pair of cute little jeans for an American Girl doll in September 2009. That pattern still is one of our best sellers 12 years later, or whatever it is, 11 years later. She updated it once, I think, in 2015, maybe. Is that passive income? Well, she did work, but in our view, it's royalty income off of work. So is it like an author's business? I mean, I got a check the other day for $2,900 for a book that I had done, years gone by. So, so this is the idea of, you know, kind of parsing out whether it's technically passive income versus a business that you've got set up with systems in place. Yeah.
So. Yeah, agreed. No, I think the differentiation is very important. I would say there's a sort of a halfway house, which is really critical, which is kind of leveraged income, which is to say you work, you know, whatever it is, maybe 20 hours a week in your business, but you are working on stuff that's going to pay off with a large amount, like product development, if it's done well, and you're selling into significant size marketplace. Again, the whole question of scalability, right? And then, onboarding, onboarding and training up great people, or indeed hiring somebody else to do that if you're working a bigger scale business. It's that sort of magnifying your effect. It's not meaning that you don't work. It just means that your work produces a greater effect. So you don't have to work lots of hours for decent money or even good money, big money.
Yeah. And of course, just in the Amazon ecosystem, of course, you have retail arbitragers come in, and then the first thing they think through is, dang, I found one of these and I sold one of them. What can I find that I can sell over and over and over again? So private label product strategies become aware of, and then replins they become aware of. So, I can find a replenishable item. I just go find the exact same thing, send it in, and that becomes very, very simple. And in essence, it's a layer of passivity, a halfway house compared to retail arbitrage, which is one product sold one time.
I think what most people, I suppose, if they've just done an employee type situation where, you know, or a self-employed person, which was my background and is my wife's, that you work X hours, you get paid, Y income times Z hours. I don't know why I use equations that way, but anyway, so, you know, and then I guess it seems passive if somebody else is working and you're not and you're still getting income, but you're right, it's not passive. I want to flag up that, do you know anyone with an e-commerce business that is 100% an owner and just passive? Because I think that's quite unusual. I think for starters, for the economics of it to work for an Amazon type business, I think you would need to grow the business from what I've seen to at least several million dollars in revenue, not profit, before you can actually afford to hire a full-time CEO, because that's a position that requires a great deal of skill. And I know one Amazon seller / Groupon. He did a lot of stuff across a lot of markets, but very smart Dutch guy in our masterminds. And he outsourced it. He hired a CEO and then fired him because it didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not easy to make happen, I think.
I think it's a question about the size of your business, to your point. If you're a hands-on operator, a personal technician in the e-commerce space, you're probably in the six or low seven figures range. Yeah. As soon as you get into the seven and eight figure range, you're not a hands-on technician. Mm. You've managed a team. And the question is, how good is your team and how good are you at managing your team?
Yeah.
And, sure, and it goes into a layer of abstraction there.
I agree that, but it's still not truly a passive. Like, for example, I own a little property which is managed for me. So it's 100% passive income. That is not the case with any Amazon business owners that I know of, because they are the CEO. They may have a lot of people, like in some cases, 20, 30 people working for them. I mean, you're in a similar situation, I guess, with Shopify. But nevertheless, they are still having to make decisions, deal with problems, whatever. So it's not passive. Whereas, you know, I guess what we're talking about with a truly passive investment, like a, you know, property traditionally, or real estate,
stocks and shares, royalty income,
it's just 100% hands off. So I think that's quite a rare situation, which is quite interesting to contemplate.
Yeah, I think the question is there's passive business and then there's passive products, I guess. And so we could distinguish between the two. But okay, so the idea though of passivity, I think we've got that nailed, right?
We've
so
got in there, yeah. Is it passive? So, yeah, sorry, we're getting in a bit too much detail here, but I didn't know it's in topics.
Let's go into the next one. So I guess the next question I would have, you know, your perspective or thoughts on digital products. I think the question is, the question I suppose we'd ask ourselves is, for the business model, can it be digitally delivered? You know, going from physical to digital is an absolutely mesmerizing thing. For those of you who have ever worked hard on a physical product and shipped it and, you know, the manufacturing, and then ever as a juxtaposition to that, worked on a digital product and then had it be out into the, you know, into the internet, into the wild. Just very, very different. What are your thoughts on how that fits in? I know it's not a common Amazon seller, at least not a common third-party seller topic. I guess merch gets towards this, but...
Yeah, I guess merch does get towards it. I mean, apart from that, the obviously, you know, Amazon is geared to that in many ways. You know, you can sell, obviously, Kindle, as you know, with your many, many Kindle books out there on Amazon. I think I've got some experience of this from the amazing FBA space. I don't know whether I call that e-commerce or not. We have a discussion about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, to some extent, it is. I think, you know, that the problem with physical products, which digital products speaks to, and obviously you know about that because that's your main business. So I'd love to ask you a couple of questions on that. But obviously the main issue is, apart from the painfulness of trying to get products moved around the world compared to via the internet, which right now a lot of people are experiencing, there's the capital requirements. It's not just about the profit margins. That's one thing. They are lower, but it's the capital requirements. They're such a killer, and that's what makes it very hard to scale a business. So to the point of scalability again, you know, can I scale this to a large number? Well, the answer is if you've got a lot of capital or it's incredibly profitable, and otherwise no. So I guess what I love about the digital products idea is that it bypasses that whole block to scalability. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what's your experience, man? You've been doing this for like 12 years now, something like that? Or no, sort of 10 years of digital.
We started our digital selling in September 2009. Well, the basic merits of the situation should not be underappreciated by anybody. And I would just say, if you're an Amazon seller, whether you're a retail arbitrage or online arbitrage, wholesale, private label, I would just encourage you to think about if you've narrowed your work down to a niche audience, is there a digital product that they could be potentially served well by? It could be a how-to guide, could be a consumer report. It could be something along those lines. If you can find an angle on a digital product, I think exploring it and thinking it through is a fantastic exercise and could be very, very meaningful for your business, because the basic math is, I think, not lost on anybody, but just let me just explain it. Digital goods work on this operating principle called near zero marginal cost. It's sort of an economist term. And what it means is it takes nothing to make the second copy. This is why Bill Gates is the richest man in the world, or maybe Jeff Bezos is, I can't remember which one, but software works on this principle as well. The first copy could take you months, and it could take you a long time to put together. And if it's software, it's super complicated. If it's an ebook, it's super simple, but it's the same principle. And that's that the first work of it, the origination of it, is hard work. It takes time and money, maybe. But then the duplication of it is literally a non-issue. And so that's the power of digital goods. And that duplication, to your point, it zeroes out the cost of goods. There is no cost of goods in a digital based model. So, for a good chunk of time, 2018, I guess I could say those stats, we did about 70,000 transactions a month. And so I didn't have to worry about inventory. It never crossed my mind. Because it's all digital. So that's the power of it. And I think we shouldn't gloss over the basic premise.
Yeah. You know, yeah. It's not just another idea. It's not just another add-on. It has different characteristics. No, I agree with that. Yeah. So I think because the power of the economics of it is so massive, and because all Amazon business sellers I've ever met, and that's probably true for people in the wider e-commerce world who I meet less, are always needing more capital, and it's always a strain, right. And they're always having to take risks with loans, or it's very hard. I would encourage everyone to go well outside their comfort zone and follow your advice, because I just think that everyone's got a digital product in them. And again, people have such lame ideas about it. They just kind of tack it on like, oh, maybe I could send them a PDF with their... People still say that now, and with their Amazon product. I'm like, no, dude, I mean, delivery to the Amazon system is really difficult for that. But also, I'm not talking about a little add-on. I'm talking about like doing it properly, which I guess is a whole different topic, how to create digital products for Amazon sellers. That there's an entire suite of discussions to be had there. But I think, we can leave that one dangling.
Okay. Yeah. Well, just to tee it up, I mean, I have a good example. One of our coaching clients will do about $5 million of physical product this year on Amazon.com. Mm. And they have a little consumer guide that they used to give it away a long time ago. They haven't published it digitally. And so just working that model with them on Shopify just is an enormous opportunity where they can give away this digital good, create leads for themselves that will then upsell people into their physical product. That's the power of adding a digital product to your physical based product ideas.
Yeah, there's a lot to deep dive into there. Yeah. Let's keep moving with the evaluation thing. Now, another piece that I know you're fond of, and I'm very passionate about this piece, is the recurring or subscription or MRR, monthly recurring revenue, whichever name you give it. Yeah. I mean, I've had a taste of that through Amazing FBA, not through the physical products world yet. Yeah. And I hope to engineer that. But yeah, that's really, really super important. Tell me about your thoughts on that.
Oh, I mean, I totally agree. It is super helpful to forecast your revenue systematically by just signing people up. Now, the universe of opportunity here on the e-commerce space has really gotten interesting. Just on the digital side, let's talk about that for a minute, and then we'll talk about physical side. The digital side, of course, people are very comfortable now with the monthly recurring, low dollar amount recurring model. It's we all have Netflix now. We all sign up for things that we just opt into that will be a $9 a month charge, $14 a month charge, $29, whatever. And those models are very, I guess you could say, trusted. They're commonly accepted by consumers. And so if you can engineer a model on the digital side where you can have monthly recurring revenue, you can scale that really interestingly. And so it could be as simple, let's say, again, Amazon seller. It could be as simple as, do you want a warranty, lifetime warranty on this product or a service contract? I mean, you can take lessons from offline operators. You know, you get a car, you get an air conditioner. There's an air conditioner installer coming to my house today. Those guys sign you up for ongoing, like, little maintenance plans. We could learn those lessons. So that's on the, you know, so that's one just, you know, kind of idea. And then, of course, there's the physical subscription box models, which have become all the rage in the last 3, 4, 5 years, where you literally say, do you want this to be sent every month? The dash button on Amazon, I know the people who helped build that, and I can talk through some of the back end detail of that if it's helpful.
Definitely. I mean,
those are the two universes. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and for me, the critical question is, how do we make physical products business into more of a recurring revenue model without necessarily involving or without it being the core? I'm not saying without. Okay. As well as perhaps the digital thing, right? But also, if we start off with the comfort zone for most people, ironically for me, because I think it's much harder to produce and ship physical goods, but for most people, it's a comfort zone in the e-commerce world, e-commerce quotes and quotes, whatever that means.
Physical.
But yeah, how to go from selling on Shopit, Amazon market or marketplaces and turn that into a revenue model, which is hard to do, but to a degree we can do it. And then on Shopify, our own site, which is obviously... Right. I guess easier. And I'd love to deep dive into both of those because I think those are very actionable, important questions that I'd love to know. I mean, what are your, on a sort of high level, what are your thoughts on that? Well, how do we?
Well, I can tell you what I've heard from, I go to church with one of the guys who helps build, works at Amazon and helped build out sort of the parts of that dash, recurring subscription button functionality from Amazon. And I can tell you what I heard, which was that was a small test that they didn't think would work, that they applied this idea to, which is just basically give people an opportunity to hit to turn a one-time purchase into a recurring reorder and, through the Amazon system. And it worked so well that they started then rolling it out through a whole bunch of products where they just wanted to, and what they realized was, you know, if you're a customer, and all of us can think through this, how often do you go back and buy a 1 pound bag of coffee? Well, when you're living your life, it becomes very routine. Do you really want to think about that? I mean, if you know you need a 1 pound bag of coffee every 10 days, is it not hard for somebody to engineer just setting that? So Amazon's cracked the code on that.
Yeah.
And it works, and they're rolling it out aggressively because consumers wanted it. And we should all learn a lesson from that. And if you're an Amazon seller, you should ask the question, can you engineer things so that there are replenishables or opportunities to have the order again, the dash, kind of button type functionality sorted out. That's top level idea, just straight, e-commerce physical product sellers should think through that,
Yeah, it's beautiful. I didn't know all that about the dashboard button. That's fascinating that it had such easy adoption by the consumers. So, that's a fantastically tempting sort of thing to try and take advantage of. And of course, completely changes in terms of then not just the sales channel, but as you were saying, business model is more than the sales channel. The product strategy, i.e. choosing stuff that can be renewable in some form, then becomes, even on the Amazon space, even more attractive than it was before. So
then it becomes fascinating. So simple. You can imagine a business model that's, even if it's, if you've sorted out your sourcing and you found sales velocity, and then it becomes mathematically simple to calculate kind of forecasted selling. You've simplified your business tremendously.
And stabilized the cash flow as well. And I guess famously that monthly recurring revenue businesses, or those with a good chunk of that, then go for bigger multiples of profits as well. So all the good things. So listen, I've managed to do the usual thing, which you came along with a beautifully clear plan and I've stuck my oar in and interfered. So I think we should,
let's summarize.
Can you summarize for us your evaluation points? Because I've kind of blurred the picture here.
No, that's fine. I think the first two questions are, is it scalable to a large number had to find that as you need to for your own situation. And then, is it defensible? So those are the top level questions. And then the secondary mm-hmm. questions you ask yourself are, you know, is it commonly achievable? You know, is it easy to operate? Is the machine you're trying to set up got a few simple levers that you can figure out how to operate? So that's the first, you know, if you want to do like a little scoring sheet. The second one would be, can it be eventually passive? And we talk through whether that means as a business level or, you know, just real passive income like royalty. So the third question can it be digitally delivered? And then the fourth one can it be a recurring or subscription-based system? Now, if you've got those, let's say there's four, just do a simple system where you evaluate what you're looking at, your own opportunity, against those factors. And if you just gave them, for example, two points each, mm-hmm. and you throw in the defensibility question, then I think you've got five there. And if they each have 2 points, then you've got a scale from 0 to 10.
Yeah.
And so then let's ask the question, you know, let's play this out for a minute, just as a recap. So let's talk about retail arbitrage. Is retail arbitrage, easily, workable? The first question is it commonly work for people?
Yeah.
I would say sure. Yeah. Retail arbitrage absolutely commonly works for people. Can it eventually be passive? Not as an individual product, right? But maybe if you had a super awesome team, so maybe not so much, maybe that's a zero on that score. Can it be digitally delivered? No, you don't do retail arbitrage digitally.
Yeah.
And can it be a recurring or subscription? No, unless you found a replins type item, and then maybe, yes. Yeah. So there you go. So it just with that retail arbitrage model, you can see it's maybe a 3 to 4, maybe it's a 5 on a scale of 0 to 10.
Yeah. I would say also defensibility is 0 for that, right? Because everyone else is selling the same product. So yeah.
That's how I would suggest you look at business models, is ask yourself these 4 or 5 questions and score them. Put the business models on paper that you're aware of, and maybe you realize the value proposition of a better business model, but you don't know how to run it. You don't know the technical points of it, and then you know which direction to go in. And I would say, in summary, a business model is a huge decision, like where you're going to live. It's like who you're going to marry. It's like, you know, it's a big question. And what I've learned is, if you start with a bad model, you will unwind that sooner rather than later. And you will want to migrate. You know, it's like if you move to the wrong house in the wrong neighborhood, you know what your future looks like. Your future looks like you're going to look for a new house in a better neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so it's the same idea with a business model. It might be harder to learn a more sophisticated model. It might feel harder on the front end, but even if it took you another year or two or three, if it gave you a railroad track to run on, that you could operate for 10, 15, 20 years, that's infinitely smarter than entering with a super sketchy model that you know in a year, two, or three, all your work is going to be flushed down the drain and you're going to have to restart and learn a different model. So I think that's the summary takeaway, is work hard to figure out the merits of a good model that you can really see yourself running for, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, passing it on to your kids, having it be a legacy, selling it someday, and work towards that high ideal rather than just jump in at the low end of the swimming pool and realize it's not where you want to live. So I think that's my summary.
Yeah, that's a great summary. And I just want to say that if you are, living in the wrong place business-wise, if you're doing, you know, a model that you feel you want to pivot out of, we are, panic not, we will be talking about an entire series of stuff about pivots and pivoting from one business model to another. It's obviously one of the more, huge ones. But there is a science and an art to that, which we will discuss. So panic not if you feel that your business model is not what you want it to be. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, thank you so much. Great stuff, man. This is so important. I love the fact that we're thinking about business model level evaluation rather than product evaluation, because that's so the level that as a business and e-commerce leader, we should be looking at, in my opinion.
Yeah, totally agree. Great conversation. And we've teed a few things up for future deep dives as well.
A lot, so. Man. Yeah, yeah. Looking forward awesome. To those.
All right, buddy.
That was the E-Commerce Leader podcast with Michael Veazey in London, England.
And Jason Miles in Seattle, Washington.
We have two free guides on sales channels for you. A PDF on how to optimize your Amazon listing for 2020 by Michael, and a video interview by Jason's partner Kyle with a client on moving onto Walmart.com. For either guide, just go to www.theecommerceleader.com/channel. Thanks for listening.